It's downtown Wednesday afternoon, 4:31, and time for this week's Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt here with us in studio.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about the famous saying by the Greek philosopher Heraclitus, you never step in the same river twice, because it's not the same river and you're not the same person. What's made me think about that is that I've encountered a number of books that I've been reading, both for the segment and for my own pleasure, that relate back. There's some relation back to a book that we did years before. Hmm. For instance, we had this wonderful book. It's got to be at least 3 or 4 years ago, Wilderness of Hope, Fly Fishing on Public Lands in the American West, by a guy named Quinn Grover, who's a professor at BYU in Idaho. And he doesn't like to give interviews, I guess. I tried to get him. It didn't work out. But he made some really key points about how differently public land is thought of in the West as here in the East. I mean, we have Baxter State Park. We have the Adirondack State Park, which is 6 million acres. We don't have huge national parks in the Northeast. We got Shenandoah and Smoky Mountain in the Southeast, but we don't have huge national parks. Mm. We have one of the most visited national parks in Acadia, but... And he talks about how so much of that land is public land, and, you know, ranchers can rent it for next to nothing and run their cattle on it. And he makes the case that you can't let all the good watersheds and everything be taken from the people by that kind of greed. It's a really good book. I really like it a lot. And then I'm reading a book because this would be for me. It's called A Distant Alien Race: The Untold Story of Franco-Americans, by David Vermette. A lot of it has to do with Franco-Americans coming to Maine. So what the hell has that got to do with Western land? And that? Well, we're getting there.
Uh-huh. There's a connection.
There is a connection.
You'll establish it, I'm confident.
We will establish it in that what brought the French-Canadian people to New England were jobs. Those jobs were in mills. Those mills were almost all powered by water. And as a result, the Androscoggin and the Kennebec and the Penobscot and other rivers in Maine were dammed, and they became what made all that work possible. What Quinn Grover talks about in Wilderness of Hope is how damming streams out west has destroyed them and how that's being changed. Then along comes my chance to finally read this book, Deep Travel and Thoreau's Wake on the Concord and Merrimack, by my friend David Leff, who passed away a few years ago now. In 2004, David decided that he was in some ways going to follow Thoreau's Concord and Merrimack trip, because he wanted to see what he could see now that Thoreau saw then. Now, Thoreau and his brother built a 14-foot skiff, and they went upstream. And then they stopped and they took a stagecoach into New Hampshire, and then they came back down. And they spent actually more than a week. And in Maine, we love the Maine woods. We love Thoreau's writings about Maine. I find his writings about the Concord and Merrimack to be very penetrating and very very observant and very worthwhile reading today. So in David's book, John Stiligo, who's a Harvard professor, wrote about it. In the hot summer of 2004, David Leff floated away from the troubles of daily life, just as Henry David Thoreau and his brother had done in their own small boat in 1839. Leff's first-person narrative uses his ecological way of looking, of going deep rather than far, not so much sightseeing as sight-seeking, to show us that our outward journeys are inseparable from our inward. I was thinking about, we've often talked about people who won't think they understand, will say baseball's boring, clearly don't understand the game, because it's the one game where something is happening all the time. I mean, the batter is thinking, well, okay, last time he got me out swinging on a low curve. There's never a moment where something isn't going on in baseball. And when you're playing that game, you have to be completely attuned to that. You can't be letting your mind wander to other things. Now, if you're not playing, how do you look at the game? Do you look at that game the same way the guy in the game does? Maybe not. Maybe you see it in an even deeper way, because maybe you're not thinking about it as personally as you are from a more global look.
Right.
Well, David took his young son, Josh, who's now a grown-up guy, hell of a good kid, his partner at the time, Pam, and a good buddy of his, who is also is a little bit curmudgeonly, and they started out. Now, what makes this interesting is that David did a tremendous amount of research ahead of time. He knew where the canal is now. He knew where you could go, where you couldn't go. And he also pointed out that the Merrimack River at one point turned more spindles than any river in America.
Hmm.
And it was also at one time terribly polluted. It's not perfect now, but it is the major source of drinking water for a great part of eastern Massachusetts. Now, David was the deputy commissioner of the Connecticut Environmental Protection Agency, a lawyer, very smart guy, an excellent poet, a particularly good prose poet. We were published by the same company. But David also wrote a book called The Last Undiscovered Place, which is about the town I grew up in, Collinsville, Connecticut, and where the famous Collins Company was and where the pikes for John Brown's raid were primarily made. And in it, he talked a lot about his relationship with the Farmington River, which is a beautiful river, rises in the Berkshire Hills and flows into the Connecticut at Windsor, Connecticut. And it turned a lot of spindles at one time, too. It doesn't much anymore. And he talked about the way a river changes and how we see it, but it's also how we see recreation in general. You know, if you're canoeing down a mucky, ugly stream, you're not paying any attention. You just want to get done, right? But if you're in a beautiful stream, you're looking at it quite differently, and your appreciation of the whole experience changes. So for fishermen, for hunters, for hikers, for cross-country skiers, backpackers, snowshoers, anybody who goes into the woods, this book tells us how to look at it in a deeper way and to look for the signs of what was there and how that may have changed. So, of course, as he goes along, especially the Merrimack, but also the Concord, they're going through all kinds of towns like Nashua, New Hampshire, and Manchester, New Hampshire, and Lowell, Massachusetts, which were homes to enormous factories. Mm. They were also the reason that Eastern New England became a place where many, many French Canadians lived. They also became the reasons why a lot of public land and smaller batches started to be conserved, because people saw the expansion of these factories as being not good for the health. What did the factories also do? Well, the factories had baseball teams and the factories, other things. So sports was always intertwined, not just fishing, not just canoeing, not just sailing. Nowadays, the Merrimack River is a huge recreational area for, you know, people that like to buzz around on personal watercraft or go bass fishing or do these other kinds of things. If Thoreau had not written his work, it's unlikely that a lot of this would be as far along today as it is. And when we think about the opportunities we have for recreational things, if Governor Baxter doesn't give us that park, I can promise you now there are sport hotels and a ski area on Katahdin, which for many reasons would be wrong, especially its sacredness to the indigenous people of Maine, but it would ruin other watersheds. So what I'm going to do is talk about where books intersect with other books over the next number of weeks. We're going to talk in detail about David's book and some of the things that he did. And I want to look at today at two quick observations that he makes. It's a little farther. It's fairly far into the book, he goes. One of the things that musicians talk about is you walk into a mall in Iowa City, or you walk into a mall in Phoenix, or you walk into a mall in Nashua, New Hampshire, and 5 minutes you're there, you think, oh, where am I? Because it's the same mall, right? And the same thing with highways, that you're driving down the highway and there's Target and Walmart and all the same stores. And the highways follow the rivers in very many places, right? Because the rivers were the normal path. And so this is, David is with his friend, Alan. We might as well be at home, Alan said, while we fretfully waited three light cycles to make a turn. Same stores, same traffic. It's like a Kafka story where you wake up and everything is like home, but it's clearly not home. You might be in California, Detroit, Atlanta, or Houston, not be able to tell the difference. How weird is that? because we identify with our landscape, right? I mean, no one thinks of Maine as strip malls, but we certainly have plenty of them, especially down the southern part of the state. And then the other one I wanted to say is, it's also a little pathetic. Think of the thousands of people who come here every day to shop. How many see this or stop and read this sign? There's a little sign about a gravesite that we'll talk about another time. Just deep travelers and people who get lost. And I think that's what we have lost, is just getting lost. And I don't mean getting lost so you can't find your way back and you spend a night on a mountain in Maine. I'm talking about the ability to just get lost in your neighborhood. You know, it doesn't have to be the wilds. I mean, you walk your dog all the time. I bet you every single day you notice something you didn't see the day before or didn't think about the day before, right? But there are people that just, they got the phone in their hand and they're walking along.
It's funny you say that, because that's why when I walk, I don't have earbuds in. I don't like to listen to anything because I want to take in what's all around me.
Me too. When I work out at the gym, I don't have them in, but everybody else does, right? And I think, I want to hear, you know, I mean, if I want to listen to music for a reason, I want to listen to music. But I see it now, even among some fly fishermen. I'll see them up on the river and they've got earbuds on. I was revising an essay I wrote years ago that I never got published, called On Listening, how everybody looks at the river and they say, I can read the water, I can read the hatch, this and that. I can listen to a river and because I've been fishing the same tailwater for 35 years and say to myself, nymphs today, dry flies near the foam. I can close my eyes and hear it. Same way at a good high-level slalom race. If I know the three gates, I can close my eyes and hear two skiers go through and know who went through faster by the sound of it. And I think that we spend so much time blocking out sound these days. And that if you really do the railroad thing, stop, look, and listen. There's so much about where you live and your relationship to the environment and your relationship to it. And if you're walking, to me, that's recreation. And recreation to me is sport.
Well, and I love, because I grew up in Bangor, I love walking with ghosts. You know, I'll set off on foot and I may not know what direction I'm going, but I don't have to go too far to find myself looking around going, boy, I would have been walking on this exact street 40, 50, 55 years ago today. And how has it changed since then? And what's the same? To find those things, I always look for traces of of the past, you know, abandoned basketball courts or things like that, traces of an old store that used to be in a spot in the days when there was a community, a neighborhood convenience store on almost every corner.
Every corner. The apartments up above and the thing on the first floor. When I was back in Collinsville, Connecticut a couple of weeks ago, which is where I lived from the time I was in kindergarten to the sixth grade, back with friends I've known since the early, from, say, 1957, 58, walking on those streets and walking by the mill and walking into the historical museum and seeing things that were part of our youth, it's not nostalgia that hits me. What hits me all the time is, this is what made me who I am. This is how I'm who I am. So when people say to me all the time, what is it that you enjoy about being on a river fishing by yourself at 5:30 in the morning? It's because it's who I am. You know, it's something that I liked when I was young and I like it today and I want to do it as long as I can. And it does teach us, I think, how we relate to sports in general, because it used to be you played sports or you watched sports. Now to be a fan is a whole different thing. People think that being a fan makes you an assistant general manager. And the playing of sports has become so organized. And you and I both lament this from the days that you went to see who was down at the field. You brought your bat, a ball, and a glove and saw who was there, and you made up a game if there weren't enough.
Well, and you'll remember from our youth, watching sports was largely watching sports in person because so few games were ever on television.
Yeah, I mean, I lived two blocks from the Little League field when I was a kid. And if I wasn't playing and there was a game going on, my brother and I, or my brothers and I, and the kids who weren't in games, who could walk within, say, you know, the half, three quarters of a mile, we'd go and watch the other teams play. You know, our parents would say, you know, come on, as soon as the game's over, come home. Don't be hanging around. Come home as soon as the game's over. And I think that my relationship was, I mean, my dad was a great swimmer. He was one of the best in New York City when he was in high school. And so I love watching swimming in the Olympics. I was never that good a swimmer, but I used to like to compete in swimming. I watched this now in the Olympics, and I think that most of the year, nobody's paying any attention to this. For 4 years, no one's paying attention to it. But those kids are down in the pool at Tennessee or UCLA or wherever they go to school, working all the time for one moment.
Well, it's like we were talking with David Roth yesterday about watching these sports that you're not accustomed to watching and not really knowing how to watch them. You sort of have to learn it as you go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I didn't know that windsurfing was an Olympic sport until I noticed it was on the other day. I've seen people windsurf, but how do you see? I'm not a big fan of sports where there's a judge. You know, figure skating, gymnastics, those are all really difficult things to do, and I have tremendous admiration for the skill it takes. But I don't want to hear how the Lithuanian judge marked somebody down by 2 points.
Right.
I want to know who was fastest, went the furthest. Right. You know, did whatever you got to do. Who scored the most runs?
Well, because you like to have that objective measurement of success and failure.
It's like the old Fabulous Sports babies say when people complain, say, score more points.
Yeah.
Tell your team to score more points.
Right.
It gets settled that way. But so we're gonna look at David's book. We also are going to be looking at, we've got some great stuff coming up, the Born to Run, about the Tara Umura racers who can get drunk all night on corn beer, put on a pair of sandals and run 100 miles through the Mexican mountains nonstop.
Oh, Lordy.
Just grabbing, you know, some water and stuff along the way, and ultra marathoners and the like. And two of Miles Schrag's books, people, important people in them, are mentioned in this. So we've got this race with Joe Vigil. And then in September, God in the Stadium, Sports and Religion in America by Robert J. Higgs. I haven't read much of this, but in 1995, he saw it all coming. The whole unholy alliance between fake Christianity and big-time sports. So we got a lot of stuff going on, and we're going to have Tim Manners will be with us the 14th.
Right.
And Russ Bradbird will be with us in September. The week I wanted him in August, it's in Ghana, so, you know. he apologized. He says, no, that's very cool. And he says, his husband is from Ghana. So I said, you can, we'll set him up in September. So we got a lot of stuff going between now and October.
Excellent. Looking forward to it. Thank you, Bruce.
You too.
Bruce Pratt, every Wednesday, Sports Lit 101 here on Downtown. We're 11 away from 5 o'clock. We'll take a break. Back in just a moment here on Z62.
Hi, this is Dewey Bunnell of the band America, and you're listening.